So it's a pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Ana Diaz-Rivero from Harvard. So Ana is a newly minted PhD as of last week. She's been working with her advisor, Cora Dvorkin, on topics related to, gravitational lensing, dark matter, statistical inference, things like that. She's had a bunch of very interesting papers actually recently. And so today, she'll tell us about the stuff that she's been doing for the past couple of years. So Anna, take it away whenever you're ready.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for the introduction and for the opportunity to present a bit of the work that I've been doing during my PhD for the last few years. As Neil mentioned, today I'm going to be talking about new ways that some collaborators and I have developed to use strong gravitational lensing as a dark matter probe. So, as a brief motivation for the talk and everything that I'm going to be introducing, of course, we all know the Lambda-Cole dark matter model. It's in its simplest form, a six-parameter model with the energy densities of different components in the universe, baryons, cold dark matter, the cosmological constant, two parameters, the curvature fluctuation amplitude and the scalar spectral index, which reflect, the power spectrum of primordial perturbations, and then the tau, which is the reionization optical depth. And of course, we know that this is a model with immense explanatory power. And we can see this if we compare Lambda CDM model fits to or predictions to actual measurements across very different cosmological observables, such as the expansion history of the universe, the CMBN isotropies, and the clustering of matter. But that's not all. Of course, there are a lot of unanswered questions. And so, despite its immense explanatory power, it's also a very unsatisfactory model because, of course, modeling something is not the same thing as understanding it. And some of the very enigmatic questions that we have yet to answer are, for example, why was there so much more matter than antimatter in the early universe? What is dark matter and what is dark energy? And why do these unknown components make up 95% of the matter density or the energy density in the universe? Of course, did inflation happen? We often assume that it did, but we don't know that for certain. And if it did happen, why did it happen the way it did, or how did it start and end? And although these are a lot of the very big questions that cosmologists try to answer today, today I'm going to be focusing specifically on one of these, which is what is the nature of dark matter, and in particular, new ways that we have to try to elucidate the microphysics of dark matter. So again, as a brief motivation, the idea is that we find excellent agreement with the very standard vanilla cold dark matter paradigm, where dark matter is cold, it's dissipationless and collisionless. This seems to match large-scale observations very well. And the idea is that because we haven't had such stringent tests of dark matter on small scales, and we can learn a lot from dark matter on these small scales because exotic dark matter physics can be imprinted on these scales, we are very interested in finding ways of probing these very small scales. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about how we can use strong gravitational lensing to do so. As a brief outline for where this talk is going to go, I'll start by talking a bit about, what we know about dark matter on galactic scales and what we don't know about dark matter on these scales. I'll introduce how we can use strong gravitational lensing to probe them or, map out the distribution of dark matter on small scales. And I'll talk essentially about two different approaches and broad strokes that people take when using strong gravitational lensing to infer something about dark matter on small scales with strong lensing, one of them, which is direct detection, a direct detection technique or approach. And I'll introduce some of our machine learning models that we've developed to do this. And I'll also talk about statistical detection. And in particular, one observable that we've worked on quite a lot, which is the convergence power spectrum. Great. So of course, the slide I showed a couple slides ago with the different cosmological observables, those are essentially nearly irrefutable evidence for the existence of dark matter. But let me focus a bit on dark matter on, at the level of individual astrophysical systems, because that's kind of, the level or the scale that we're going to be talking about from here on out. So it's better this way to build a bit of intuition. So we know that about 80%, 85% of the matter, all the matter in the universe is in the form of cold dark matter. So it's some unknown dark component whose presence we infer by its gravitational effects. On the left, you can see an image of a galaxy where you can see very clearly at the very center the stellar disk. But if you map the gas surface isodensities, you can see that they have a much larger spatial extent. And this is, of course, due to the presence of a large dark matter halo that keeps the gas virially bound in this galaxy. On the right is a galaxy rotation curve, very famously first measured or mapped out by Vera Rubin. And the idea is that if you try to measure the galaxy rotation curve of spiral galaxies, you see a very large difference between the expectation of a rotation curve without dark matter. So if you're only basing yourself on the luminous components of the galaxy and what you actually measure with this large excess due to the presence of dark matter, and in particular, you know, this large dark matter halo within which the actual luminous component is only a very small component of the very center of the halo. And to a very good approximation, it seems to be cold collisionless and dissipationless. This is a figure of the very famous bullet cluster, which is actually, you know, a group of two clusters that at some point in the past collided with each other. And if you compare the mass density contours, which you can measure from weak lensing, to the actual baryonic contents of these clusters, which you can see as hot X-rays, X-ray gas, then you can see that there's a large offset between the center of the dark matter halos and the actual baryonic components, which tells you that while the gas of these two clusters heavily interacted with each other and was thus dragged while the clusters interacted, the two clusters essentially crossed by each other unimpeded. And so with measurements like this, we can put constraints on the interaction cross-section of dark matter, which seems to be very, very, very small, if not zero. And if we look at even smaller scale, so if we want to look within, for example, a single galactic halo, we know that due to hierarchical structure formation, we expect an abundance of structure within each of these halos. So for example, here on the left is a projected dark matter density for a high resolution and body simulation of a Milky Way sized halo. And you can see that there's a huge number of smaller dark matter overdensities everywhere within this halo. And you can see this in a statistical point of view from looking at the subhalo mass function, which you can see is essentially a very steep power law. And this slope is quite consistent between different n-body simulations and seems to have a logarithmic slope of around -1.9. And of course, we know that these small dark matter clumps actually exist. For one, we've observed them as Milky Way satellite galaxies. So these are little galaxies that are themselves orbiting within the larger dark matter halo of the Milky Way. And this is an example from, I guess, 5 years ago now, of some of the Milky Way satellite galaxies that have actually been found. And people do point to the discrepancy between the predicted abundance of these halos and the observed abundance of these halos, you know, so-called missing satellite problems and so on and so forth. But I won't really get into any of that today. I'm going to be completely agnostic to whether these issues are real or whether they're just, you know, a function of the fact that there were no baryons in the simulation, so on and so forth. The point is that there are some clumps and we want to know exactly, you know, what is the abundance of these clumps or what are their features. And as I've tried to emphasize with the introduction, the point is that it's very hard to gauge cold dark matter on small scales, and we haven't definitively done so in a satisfactory way. And this is due to several reasons. For one, you know, at low redshifts on these very small scales, we're very deeply in the nonlinear regime, which means that we need n-body simulations for predictions. And not only that, but actually what we need are hydrodynamical simulations because we can't ignore baryonic physics or astrophysics on these scales. Observationally, we have the additional challenge that as we decrease the halo mass, so as we're looking at smaller and smaller halos, stellar formation is more and more inefficient, which means that these are essentially dark clumps, and we can't use their light to find them. And of course, the whole point of this talk is that dark matter models that behave like cold dark matter on very large scales can have very different effects on subgalactic scales. And to illustrate this, I took this figure from one of my papers where we compare the projected surface mass density of an n-body simulation in a CDM scenario, which is shown here on the left, to an n-body simulation run with the exact same initial condition. So you can see that the large scale features are the same between these two panels, but adding a bit of exotic dark matter microphysics. And the details of this of these exotic processes aren't super relevant right now, but the point is that they cause the halos to be much more susceptible to tidal stripping. So they are a lot less dense than their CDM counterparts. And you can see that what that means is that when you compare the surface mass densities of both of these scenarios, there's a lot of structure that has been erased over here on the right compared to the panel on the left. So the idea is that because exotic dark microphysics can lead to interesting phenomenology on small scale, on small scales that is observably different from CDM, we can use these small scales to either falsify or corroborate the CDM paradigm. And the way we're going to be doing this is using strong gravitational lensing. In its most basic form, it's something that we've all heard about, right? You have some background source of light, and as the photons of this source of light stream towards us, if there's some large massive body in its path, it can deflect its path significantly. And in particular, if it's a very massive body, you can have these huge distortions in the shape of the source. What gravitational lensing really is in its simplest form is just a mapping between the source plane and the image plane, given by a deflection vector field, which is itself just the gradient of the gravitational potential of this object doing the lensing. So this massive body between the source and the observer. But you can use it as a small scale probe. And this was suggested, I guess, over 20 years ago now, by Mann Schneider, who suggested explaining some flux ratio anomalies in lens quasars by the presence of dark matter clumps near one of the images. And I'll talk a bit about how this has kind of morphed into the way people look for substructures today. But let me just emphasize that the advantage of this method is that it's fully baryon independent, right? It's just a gravitational effect. And although you can imagine that, you know, in all the observations of strong gravitational lensing that we see in the universe, there are a lot of different types of sources and a lot of different scales of objects doing the lensing. But in this talk, I'm going to focus on a very specific subset of these systems, which are called galaxy-galaxy lenses, where the object being lensed is a galaxy and the object doing the lensing is also of galaxy scale. And the point of this is that if the object in the lensing is on these scales, then the perturbations, so these smaller dark matter clumps that we're measuring, are precisely on the scales that we can use to falsify the CDM paradigm by looking at the absence or presence of these small scale clumps. So I'm going to be talking about two different, you know, general approaches to this problem, one being direct detection, where the goal is essentially to try to identify and resolve individual perturbers, so individual dark matter clumps and infer their properties, which is usually limited to just their mass and their position. And then the flip side of that coin is statistical detection approaches, where you want to marginalize over the individual subhalo properties in favor of population level characteristics. And for now, I'm going to focus on direct detection. It's a much more intuitive and easy to visualize approach to this problem. And once we've built this intuition, we can move on to talking also about statistical detection techniques. So the quintessential modern technique for direct detection is gravitational imaging, led, of course, by Simona Vigetti over at the Max Planck Institute. And the idea is similar to what I brought up with Mann Schneider. The idea is that if you have some dark clump lying close to a lensed image and projection, of course, it can cause some distortion that you can actually detect. The entire detection pipeline is very neatly illustrated by this figure taken by one of Simona Vigetti's papers. Up on the top left, you have an actual example of a lensed galaxy. And the way that you can ultimately turn this data image into a detection is by a series of steps. For one, you start by assuming that the object doing the lensing is completely smooth, and you try to build a lens model that is smooth, okay? So it doesn't have any of these additional dark matter clumps. If you have such a model and you reconstruct the source, then what you can do is forward model the source through the gravitational potential of your smooth model to generate a smooth model image. And that's what's shown over here in this top center panel. What you could then do is look at the residual between the data and the smooth model, which is what's shown over here on the right, and then try to minimize this residual by adding small potential corrections. And if you do that, you get something like this lower center panel over here. And of course, from the potential corrections to surface mass density, all you need is a Laplacian. So you can reconstruct the surface mass density that minimizes the residual between your smooth model and your data. And you can see that in this particular case, it leads to a smaller redensity over here at the top of the image. And this was a 10 to 12 sigma claimed detection of a dark matter clump at this specific position in the image.
So if that was the 10 sigma, then are those other things like 5 sigma?
mm-hmm. Yeah, so this one in particular is 10 Sigma. Maybe later I can talk a bit more about how they can claim this very, very high statistical significance, and in particular, what tests they run to make sure that, you know, these aren't artifacts of mismodeling or mismodeling the source and so on and so forth. But they definitely have some lower sensitivity ones, although they try to be very stringent when they actually claim a detection. So they'll have papers where they show, you know, like, oh, we find this one at 5 sigma or something like that, but they don't actually go on to claim definitively that they, you know, trust that result.
Uh-huh. So they don't trust 5 sigma in their analysis.
Yeah, I think their lower bound might be 10 sigma or something like that, like very, very, very high.
Yeah, well, right. But that just makes you wonder if they have estimated sigma, right?
Yes.
Because in this like potential plot, right? You know, so you see this like threefold, you know, perturbation structure, you know, and all three potential perturbations seem to be similar in size. But then, I mean, right, you know, but on the right, those three blobs are not the same size. And so something weird is going on.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point that I hadn't thought about. Well, so one thing they do is they compare. So they do this two ways. They do it kind of parametrically also, where they try to literally, they assume like a pseudo Jaffe profile or something like that in a little subhalo, and they will literally also move that around the image. So it explores like huge parameter space to try to determine whether you want to have a subhalo or not. And then they compare this kind of pixel-based potential correction to the parametric fit, where you literally, you know, just play around with the position and the mass of some analytical subhalo. And then they only claim a detection if both methods agree, roughly at least, in terms of the location and the mass of the overdensity.
Uh-huh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the example of the pixel-based correction, but they always have that like additional test with this like analytical little subhalo, and sometimes they find that only one of the two suggests, you know, gives some statistically significant evidence for the presence of the subhalo. And in those cases, they don't claim it's an actual detection.
Right, okay. But if they see like 5 sigma things happening frequently, then it means that 5 sigma is not 5 sigma, right?
Well, it's not frequent. I will say like there may be, I don't remember the exact number now, but I think of like their very strongly claimed detections, there's two of them. And I think there's like a third one that was a less significant one. So it's still like a very rare thing. So there's like 1 5 sigma, I think, and then there's two of these like 10 to 12 sigma detections.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. But of course, as you can imagine, measuring only one clump in a single image doesn't actually tell you anything about the nature of dark matter, right? What you need is a statistical probe of dark matter, because that's what dark matter theories give you. A dark matter theory doesn't predict exactly one clump at this position, but rather some abundance. So for example, you know, with a dark matter theory, you can obtain a subhalo mass function, and that tells you, for example, on average, how much substructure you expect to find. So to actually put some constraints on dark matter, what they need is an additional step, which is called the sensitivity function. And this is something that has to be built on an image by image basis. And what it actually is you look at your data and you essentially try to determine what is the minimum subhalo mass that you are sensitive to in every pixel in your image. So this is the actual data image. And here on the right is its corresponding sensitivity function, where you can see that, you know, very close to the brightest pixels in the lensed image, they expect to be quite sensitive to very low masses. And of course, as you go further away from the brightest pixels, you are essentially insensitive to the presence of substructure. And that way they can essentially combine detections and non-detections by using a joint likelihood for a whole series of images. And that way they place constraints on the subhalo mass function. And as I mentioned, so far there have been two detections, one being a few times 10 to the 8 solar masses and one being a few times 10 to the 9 solar masses, using this method with around 30 images having been analyzed. And the point that I want to bring up is that this is a very computationally expensive process. So between having to do the smooth model, reconstruct the source, and then having to do this whole sensitivity function approach, and then constrain the presence of substructure by minimizing the residual, it can take a very long time, like on the order of weeks, to do this for a single system. But of course, over the next few years, we're expecting thousands and thousands of these high quality lenses to be available for such studies. And obviously, it's impossible to spend weeks on each of these systems. So we had a first paper where we tried to kind of speed up this whole process by translating the entire detection problem into a binary classification task, where we tried to, you know, train a convolutional neural network to predict whether an image has a nearby perturber or not to identify promising candidates. The idea is that because most of the images analyzed with gravitational imaging yield non-detections, if we could identify the ones that would benefit from all this additional modeling, then we could cut down analysis time and resources considerably. And of course, if we understand the sensitivity of the network well enough, we're not saying that you throw away the images with non-detections, but you could still leverage them, like we could still leverage those non-detections together with the actual detections in the same way as is done traditionally with the sensitivity function. And what we found, what we found is that with this very simple network architecture that we use, we were sensitive to subhalos with masses around 10 to the 9 solar masses with realistic levels of noise. And we looked also at the effect of correlated noise, which could, of course, mimic the effect of substructure better than uncorrelated white noise, and found that in that case, of course, we needed higher subhalo masses in order to actually distinguish them. But we mentioned in our paper that we could improve the sensitivity of a machine learning type of approach using one of these like well-known architectures for image recognitions like ResNet and DenseNet. And that's exactly what we did in a follow-up paper, where we tried to cut out the middleman entirely. So we wanted to turn the entire detection problem into an image segmentation task with a very well-known architecture for this type of problem called UNET. And image segmentation is a broad class of problems where you essentially try to identify objects in images by classifying every pixel in an image as belonging to a predetermined class. So you can imagine, for example, for a self-driving car, you might want to train a self-driving car to identify, you know, what's a tree, what's a human, what's another car, a sidewalk, stuff like that. So this is an analogous problem, but of course in a completely different setting, which is identifying substructure. So here on the left is a schematic depiction of the network architecture, which again was not developed by us. It was developed actually for, I think, medical imaging. But it's called UNET because it has this U-like structure. It has a contracting path and an expanding path. And what really matters for our intents and purposes is that the input to the image, to the network, is a strong lens image. So you can see here it's an 80 by 80 pixel strong lens image with a single channel. And the output of the network has the same X and Y dimension. So it's still going to be 80 pixels by 80 pixels, but now it's an 11 dimensional channel tensor. So now we have 11 80 by 80 pixel images. And this is because we chose there to be 11 classes in our problem. Okay, so what the network outputs is actually a probability map for each of 11 possible classes, meaning that it tells you for every single pixel in the image, what's the probability of that pixel belonging to one of the 11 classes. And once you have this 11-dimensional tensor, you can then essentially assign each pixel in the actual output to belong to the class with the highest probability. And that's how you end up with a one-dimensional target image. And so let me show you actually what these actually look like, which might make you understand a little bit better what I'm talking about. In the top row, you can see on the very left, the actual input to the network. Okay, so this is just a strong lens image with where we've chosen a smooth model, we've chosen some source model, and of course the presence of a subhalo. And you can see that here in the middle, this is what we want the network to predict. Okay, so this is our target. We want the network to classify all the uninteresting pixels as just belonging to the background. All the pixels within the strong lens, so basically within the Einstein ring of the lens, as belonging to the main lens. And then we wanted to locate a small subhalo that we've placed over here. Okay, this is a very, very low mass subhalo. This is a 10 to the 6 solar mass subhalo. And on the right, you can see what the network actually predicted. And you can see that it did a very, very good job of matching what we wanted to match, right? And in particular, it did a very good job of identifying the subhalo. But how we actually obtain this prediction map is through these 11 different probability maps. So redder colors correspond to low probabilities and bluer colors correspond to high probabilities. And each of these images is one of the network outputs for each of the 11 possible classes. So there's the background class, the main lens class, and there are several different mass bins that a subhalo can actually belong to. And so you can see that the network predicts with very high confidence what the background pixels are, what the main lens pixels are, and also with quite high with quite high confidence, it predicts there to be this very low mass subhalo in the 10 to the 6 solar mass category over here. And you can see, though, that there are some issues with edge effects, not only for the subhalo, but also for the main lens in the background. But overall, the point is that the network does a very, very good job of localizing this very, very small overdensity.
So can I ask, you know, what this plot means? So should I interpret this as like the probability that there is like some mass of some like spatial profile and that normalization at that location? Is that what that means?
Yes. Exactly.
And so how do then like, okay, well, right. So then why is like the, like, you know, like for the main lens, why is it so extended? I mean, you know, cause you're assuming some spatial profile for it, right?
Yeah. So for the main lens, that's a good question. So basically how we go about labeling these pixels, let me move to this. I'll come back to this later, but okay, to give you an idea of how we're actually defining these things. So we specifically, so you can do it in two ways, basically. You can either label, you can have your target be based exactly off the convergence map. So for example, we could use something like this as our target and use, I don't know, put some convergence threshold on the pixels that we want to be labeled in a certain way. The problem with using an approach like this, we found, is that, of course, if you do this, then you give very different numbers of pixels to high mass halos than small mass halos, right? So, for example, here you see a very huge halo, and that would take up quite a few pixels. And over here you see very, very small halos, which would maybe have one pixel. And we found that the network did a very, very bad job of predicting, of predicting the target when we use a method like this to construct our targets. So what we did instead is define things slightly differently in an unphysical way, right? So this target, of course, is not the physical convergence field. You can see that all the subhalos, although they have very different masses, they all have the exact same or roughly the exact same spatial extent. So it's more or less a circle with a radius of 2 pixels. And the main lens, again, it's not exactly defined by its convergence. It's rather just all the area encompassed within the Einstein radius or the Einstein ring of the image. So we had to use kind of this unphysical target for the network in order for it to be more trainable. So of course, what this means is that in some sense, this isn't like if we wanted to reconstruct a model independent convergence field, then we can't do something like this, right? Because if I wanted to construct a convergence field from a target like this, I would have to impose some model for the subhalo or whatever to actually build a convergence field.
I see. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, great. I'll be back to that slide in a second, but let me just show you a bit of a more systematic way that we have to actually gauge the network performance, because of course, you know, this is just one example and it might work very well in this example, but not overall. So instead, what we can do is look at the confusion matrix, which tells you for a given type of target pixel, with what frequency was it assigned to each of the possible 11 classes. Okay, so on the x-axis, these are the target classes, and on the y-axis, these are the predicted classes. And note that we do normalize each column to add to unity, so you can think of these as sort of probabilities or frequencies that sum to one. And so if you see a very diagonal matrix, what that's telling you is that your network is very often predicting the right class for a given target pixel, right? And off-diagonal elements are, of course, misclassifications. But you can see two things. And let me emphasize for starters that I'm looking at this plot on the left. So this corresponds to a network trained and tested on images with no noise. And you can indeed see that the confusion matrix is very diagonal. And although you do see some off-diagonal elements, in general, they are limited to being in the two adjacent mass bins to the true target class. And that, of course, comes from the fact that we're turning a continuous problem, which is subhalo masses, into a discrete problem by imposing specific mass bins. So that's kind of an artificial effect from the way we've done the binning. But not only that, you actually see that at the very lowest masses, so you know, between 10 to the 6 to around 10 to the 7 solar masses, you also see a non-negligible amount of pixels that get confused with the main lens or the background, because of course we're looking at extremely, extremely small perturbations. And we can also look at a network trained and tested on images with 1% noise. And now you see that as expected, you've essentially erased the sensitivity of the function below a certain mass. In this case, it happened to be 10 to the 8 solar masses. And we were able to show in our paper that you can actually map this very well, like the sensitivity of the network to the actual fractional change in brightness caused by the presence of a substructure. And we found exactly that adding 1% noise, which is realistic HST noise, would lead to erasing perturbations below the 10 to the 8 solar mass threshold. So you can now see that below the 10 to the 8 solar mass, the network essentially predicts all the subhalo, any subhalo with these masses to just be a background halo and sometimes a main lens halo. But the interesting thing is that we can actually identify many subhalos at a time. We don't have to do it one subhalo at a time. And we can also stack images together to obtain constraints on the subhalo mass function. So here on the left is the figure that I was discussing just a few minutes ago, where our target now has a whole slew of different subhalos with very, very different masses. And you can see that the network prediction is pretty good. Of course, it's missed a few, especially some of the halos very close to the edges of the image, far away from the actual lensed images. But it still does a very good job of recovering multiple halos, even some that are quite low in mass, like this one, for example. And on the right are the actual constraints on the logarithmic slope of the subhalo mass function that we're able to obtain directly within our pipeline. And you can see that each of these panels corresponds to stacking a different number of images. So from 10 images all the way up to 1,000 images. And the x-axis gives you the actual logarithmic slope. The true value is -1.9, and that's shown in these dotted lines, vertical lines in each of the panels. And you can see that as I add more and more images, of course, my constraints get a lot better on the subhalo mass function logarithmic slope. And you can see the blue and orange lines correspond to images with no noise in blue and with 1% noise in orange. And I guess it's kind of hard to see the actual numbers from these images, but basically, as soon as I have around 50 images, I have error bars on the level of 10%, which is really good. And if I go all the way up to 1,000 images, then I'm on the order of 2%. And in this bottom right panel, you can see kind of the progression of the error bars as I add more and more images. So that was the work that we've done on direct detection-like techniques, or how we've tried to enhance them. Now let me switch gears and talk about something pretty different, which is the statistical detection technique.
So you said that you were adding like noise levels that were similar to HST noise for the simulations. So since you're getting these tight constraints, you know, for simulated data whose noise is similar to real HST data, mm-hmm. then have you then tried, you know, actually looking at real HST lenses?
So we're working on that now. So one thing that we're working on quite a bit now, which is, well, there's a lot of things that you have to worry about, okay? Obviously going from simulations to the data. One of them is the noise, which we've worked on quite a lot. And the other one is, that's very, very important, is the source structure. Mm-hmm. So one important, I guess, assumption of the data that we're simulating is that for all our images in our training set and our test set, we take the source to be essentially a superposition of a different number of clumps. So it can have between 1 and 5 clumps, but they're all modeled to be circ ellipses. And these are somewhat simplified sources. Like we try to make them, you know, clumpy galaxies, but of course they're not quite as complex as a real image. And there's quite a large degeneracy between the source and the substructure. So we've been working quite a bit on more realistic models for the sources. And we find, thankfully, that the network still does extremely well. But we have to be very careful at like matching all the HST specifications and characterizing, you know, how, if there is some difference, unbeknownst to us, between the real data and how we choose to model, like how that impacts the actual constraints. So that's what we've been working on now.
Okay, great, thanks.
Great. Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously it's the ultimate thing that's interesting, right? If you can't apply it to real data, it's useless. So we've been putting a lot of hard work into taking that extra step. But yes, as I said, let me switch over to talk about statistical detection, where I now don't want to identify these individual halos. I don't really care about where they are. I care about the population level parameter. So for example, the subhalo mass function slope and the subhalo mass function amplitude. And this, of course, I can do because I expect a very, very large number of unresolved low mass structures, in, at least in CDM, right? Of course, exotic dark matter scenarios can change that. But remember that in at least in CDM, the subhalo mass function is a pretty steeply sloped function of the mass. And before I actually talk about the convergence power spectrum, which is the observable of interest, let me take just a few minutes to discuss a very important assumption that I've been making so far in this talk. And that's that I've been talking about perturbations being due to substructure, meaning little halos virially bound to the main object doing the lensing, right? So for example, the Milky Way satellite galaxies, which are traveling within the Milky Way halo host. And the point is that, of course, there's no reason to believe that the entire line of sight volume between the observer, the lens, and the source is empty. And in fact, we expect there to be so-called interloper halos, which can themselves act as perturbers, since in projection, they too can lie on the lens plane. So the point that I'm going to be making over the next couple of minutes is that understanding whether the subhalos or the interlopers are the dominant contribution is going to be crucial when translating any detection from a strong lens system into a constraint on dark matter. And this can be succinctly phrased as follows. The idea is that the subhalo mass function is not the same thing as the low mass end of the halo mass function. And in fact, the subhalo mass function is some very complex, highly processed version of the halo mass function, where just schematically, this function can be thought of as depending on a lot of things that are very hard to pin down and that we don't understand very well. Some of these variables can be the host mass and the host redshift, but of course, it also depends on the subhalo population, their masses, the redshift at which they were accreted. It can depend also on, for example, the baryonic content of the main lens. It can depend on the baryonic content of the actual subhalos. There's a lot of things that we don't know how to model very well and we don't understand very well that will map the halo mass function to what would be observed in a subhalo mass function. And the point is that if the dark matter clumps that dominate these signals are interlopers, what we can actually probe is the halo mass function. While if the thing that's dominating the signal are subhalos, then what we're actually probing with these measurements is the subhalo mass function. And of course, one of them is a lot easier to tie to dark matter theories than the other. And that's the halo mass function, right? Because if I want to tie the subhalo mass function back to theory, then I have to have some way of robustly accounting for all these other confounding factors that will change the halo mass function away from, you know, the actual dark matter theory. And so, so for the remainder of the talk, I'm going to be discussing the interloper contribution and the subhalo contribution, okay? And this is something to keep in mind going forward. So the observable I'm going to be talking about is the convergence power spectrum. And the convergence is just a fancy way of calling the surface mass density. It's called like this because it's in units of the critical density for lensing. But the convergence power spectrum is a very interesting observable because it provides a neat bridge between what we have, which is strong lens images, and what we actually want, which are dark matter theories. Right? So what we want is some way of going through this arrow, going from our actual observable to a dark matter theory. What strong lens images actually give us are deflection vectors on the lens planes, you know, some length scale. Well, what dark matter theories give us, for example, a subhalo or a halo mass function. So that's some mass scale. And the convergence power spectrum is the perfect bridge between mass scales and length scales. And that's why it's a very interesting observable to extract from strong lens images to do dark matter science. And although I made a big deal about the interloper versus the subhalo contribution, let me start off by considering the limits where all perturbers are actually substructure. And then I'll move on to talk about this harder problem where you consider the entire three-dimensional volume of perturbers and how that affects the power spectrum. We can start off in this limit because it's, of course, a lot simpler to work in this limit. And we can gain a bit of intuition of how different dark matter microphysics get imprinted on the power spectrum before moving on to this more complicated scenario. So in the limit where all the perturbers are substructure, we have a single well-defined convergence, right? So everything happens at the exact same redshift, which is the redshift of the main lens. We have a single critical density for lensing. And what we can do is we can take the total convergence on the lens plane and decompose it into a smooth component, which we don't care about for the remainder of this talk, and the substructure component, which is, of course, what we what we actually care about. And we can decompose the entire substructure contribution to the convergence into the contribution of each individual subhalo, which is going to be a function of its position, its mass, and any other relevant internal profile parameters. So for example, if you have a population of NFW halos, then this Q parameter vector could be the scale radius, but it could really be whatever you want. And what we can do is, kind of following the halo formalism, we can derive an expression for the substructure power spectrum, which is a combination of a one subhalo term and a two subhalo term. And the formalism is fully general, and you can include non-trivial correlations between subhalos that will give rise to an actual two subhalo term. But for the remainder of the talk, let me ignore the two subhalo term and focus just on the one subhalo term. And this is what the one subhalo term looks like generally. So I haven't imposed any specific convergence profile. What you can see is that there are certain ingredients. For one, you need a convergence profile. So for example, a projected NFW profile could be your convergence profile. And of course, the one subhalo term is just an ensemble average over the Fourier transform of the convergence profile squared. And we do the ensemble average over two different probability distributions, one of them to account for the masses of the subhalos, and the other can account for any other relevant profile properties. So for example, again, in the case of an NFW profile, this would be for the scale radius. And this is what the one subhalo term actually looks like, modeled for a population of NFW or truncated NFW halos. You can see that at low k's, it plateaus and it has an amplitude determined by the average abundance of substructure. You can also get information on the largest subhalos in your problem. The intermediate slopes tell you something about the concentration of the subhalos, as well as the slope of the subhalo mass function. And finally, at the very highest k's, you can actually, you're actually probing the very inner density profiles of the halos. So you could, for example, use this to distinguish between a cuspy population of halos versus a core population of halos. And this, of course, is interesting just because it brackets kind of the entire range of possibilities of cuspiness or coredness of dark matter halos, which people are very interested because, you know, the cuspiness predicted by CDM, which seems to not be well matched with observations on these small scales, which seem to be more cored. So that's just to bring up that you know the very highest K regime of the power spectrum could distinguish these two scenarios. But of course, what we care about are the most observable scales, or the ones that we're going to be able to probe the best or put the best constraints on. Here on the left, I'm showing the power spectrum extracted from a high-resolution n-body simulation of a Milky Way-sized halo. And in particular, the four different panels correspond to four different projections of the same halo. For each panel, you'll see that there's several different curves with different colors. The dark blue curve corresponds to the total convergence power spectrum. And then each of the other curves corresponds to the contribution to the power spectrum of a specific mass bin. And I realized that the legend is kind of small, so it's hard to see. But basically, the light blue curve corresponds to the highest mass bin. So those are subhalos between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 10 solar masses. While the red curve corresponds to the lowest mass bin, which is between 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 solar masses. And if you look at this red rectangle in each panel, and I'll explain in a second what this red rectangle actually is. If you look at this area, you can see that the dominant contribution comes from this green line in all four projections. And this green line actually corresponds to the second to lowest mass bin. So this corresponds to halos between 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 solar masses. And the interesting thing that this is showing us is that unlike in direct detection, where by construction you are most sensitive to the most massive subhalo in your problem and in your actual image, here the higher abundance of lower mass halos can sometimes win out, and meaning that it can dominate the signal more than the lower abundance of higher mass halos. So that's quite an interesting advantage of the statistical technique compared to a direct detection technique. And what this red rectangle actually corresponds to are the scales shown over here. So the plot here on the right is taken from a paper of one of my collaborators, where he shows in as this green shaded contours, the scales that we can actually hope to observe or measure in the near future with both space-based observations and interferometric data. So we're showing that on the scales that we're going to be most sensitive to, we can actually be sensitive to lower mass halos if they are, you know, more abundant than their higher mass counterparts.
So
and the last
so yes. Anna, like Can you remind me, so in our paper, did we find like a similar like result that the low mass things dominated? Because it seems surprising to me, actually.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
So if we just look at like the matter power spectrum in 3D, mm-hmm. right? Like the smallest halos don't dominate until like super high K. Mm-hmm. And so why is it here that you're finding that the smallest things are dominating, so early, at some like lower K, then do you find that the higher mass things win or?
Yeah. So look, if you look outside of the actual, and remember this is now on a linear scale. So for example, here, this was logarithmic. So this is on a linear scale. If you look at the very lowest K, you still do find that the highest mass bin does dominate. Right, so in like this light blue curve is going to dominate. Well, in this particular one, it's the black curve, I think, because in this particular case, there were no halos in this other mass bin. But it's only when you move to sufficiently high K that you actually find that, the green line dominates.
Okay, yeah, so it's hard for me to, the light blue curve you're saying is a high mass bin?
Yes, sorry, I know it's such a small legend. So the light blue corresponds to 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 solar masses. So in most projections where, I mean, these are very rare, right? So in this Milky Way size halo, there's like a handful, like maybe 3 or 4 halos in this mass bin. So whether they are or not in a projection, of course, is it doesn't always happen. So you can see that here, for example, where there's literally 0 of them. If they are there, they do dominate the smallest K. But once you move to sufficiently high K, then the much higher abundance of these much less massive halos wins out.
And this is because of like the internal profile of these big subhalos. What are you assuming then, I guess, like for the internal profiles?
So here right now, this is just taken from an n-body simulation. So here we didn't do any specific modeling ourselves. These subhalos are of course very well fit with NFW profiles. So we can do like, for example, from a subhalo catalog, you can compare what the subhalo catalog gives you to the actual surface mass density from the n-body simulation and find that they're very well fit with NFW halos. We did this exercise as well for the exotic dark matter scenario that we were looking at, which I'll mention very briefly here. The idea is that we were comparing a CDM simulation to this other exotic dark matter simulation called ETHOS-4, where basically the two main differences were that there was a low mass cutoff and also that there were some small self-interactions between dark matter particles, which made the subhalos be a lot less centrally dense and much more prone to tidal stripping. And in our paper, I don't have it in these slides, but in our paper, we also showed these projections for this exotic dark matter scenario and found that we essentially saw the same thing. So even though the inner density profile was quite different, the overall conclusion was the same.
Uh-huh. Like so each of these curves is like a decade in mass, is that right? Like
exactly.
And it's based off of a simulation. So you have simulations that are covering like 4 or 5 decades of subhalo mass?
Exactly. So the one,
can I ask them about like the, it's hard to, it's hard to resolve many decades of structure, right, in a mm-hmm. simulation. So can I ask, things like the spatial resolution of the sim compared to like the subhalo size, the mass resolution of the sim?
Yeah, of course. So one thing to keep in mind is that this this high resolution n-body simulation was of a Milky Way sized halo, which is of course slightly smaller than the typical galaxy lenses, which have masses, more on the Earth 10 to the 13 solar masses. So that's one disclaimer. In terms of the resolution of the simulation,
you were saying this is these sims were for one halo. Is that what you said?
Yeah. So this is one high resolution Milky Way sized simulation. And these are different projections of that halo.
Ah, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Thanks.
Let me just quickly answer just your question about the resolution. So we did limit our analysis to halos that had at least 50 particles in them, which correspond to a few times 10 to the 6 solar masses. So that's the lowest mass that we are willing to trust or do anything with from the simulation.
50 particles.
But, yes.
Okay. That is pushing it. But.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, that's why, and again, I don't have slides on this here, but in our paper, we compare quite a lot the like results from the subhalo catalog where you have to, you know, assume something about, so for example, I can take 50 particles and, you know, put some density profile over it, but obviously that's not very well defined because there's very few particles. And we kind of compare what answer we get from looking just at the particle simulation snapshots to using this kind of subhalo catalog approach where you have to impose some density profile. And we do find that like adding, so imposing some density profile, in particular, a cuspy density profile like the NFW, you are adding some essentially fake power on the very, very highest k's.
Fake power.
Like you're overestimating the power.
Yeah, but how do you know that's not correct, right? You know, because your simulation isn't resolving.
Oh, yeah, of course. No, this is just like, you can never know like how correct the simulation is. It's just comparing, I guess, kind of a halo model type of view of assuming, you know, each of my clumps is some spherical or elliptical clump and I impose some density profile compared to just the particle level of the simulation. Then of course, there's always the question of whether the particle level of the simulation, how accurate that is. And that we don't have an answer to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Thank you.
Great. So the last thing I wanted to mention was, just looking at the redshift dependence of the convergence power spectrum for the exact two simulations that I was just discussing now. And if you look at the CDM evolution with redshift of the power spectrum, it's quite intuitive, right? So as you evolve further on in time, so from redshift 1 to redshift 0, the amplitude is increasing as you're accreting more and more structure. If you do the same exercise, but for this exotic simulation where, you know, the subhalos are much more prone to tidal stripping, you see something quite different, which is that now the amplitude between the redshift of 0.5 and 0 actually stalls because the influx of additional substructure being accreted is offset by the increase in tidal stripping of these halos as they're orbiting the host. So now you can actually see that the amplitude is essentially indistinguishable between these two different redshifts. And this is kind of illustrating what I brought up before of the kind of the messiness of the subhalo mass function. And how if what we're really probing are subhalos and not interloper halos, meaning that what we're really probing is the subhalo mass function, we need to, for some way of modeling all these additional processes that could, you know, essentially bias our final determination on the particle nature of dark matter. So with all that in place, we can now move on to considering the, you know, more realistic, more complicated scenario of the entire line of sight volume having potential perturbers. This is a cartoonish depiction of the problem. So now, you know, between the observer, the main lens, and the source, there are some other little halos that can themselves, in projection, lie over the relevant area of the main lens, of the strong lens plane. And so instead of having a single lens plane, now we have a lens plane at many different redshifts, meaning that I don't have a single well-defined convergence, but rather at each redshift with each perturber, there's an associated convergence. And of course, they each have their own critical density, critical surface mass density. And I can no longer use the kind of vanilla simple lens equation. And I have to use the multi-lens plane equation, which is a recursive equation that essentially couples successive lens planes. And in order to turn this into a tractable problem, what we can do is define an effective convergence, where you essentially treat the interlopers as effective subhalos by projecting them onto the main lens plane. And what this does is essentially imagine for the ith interloper at some random redshift, it essentially rescales its convergence. It gives it an effective mass and an effective scale radius, again, assuming an NFW-like subhalo, in such a way that you can now model it as being at the exact same redshift as the lens. And this is shown, you know, using the same critical surface mass density as the one at the lens. And if you do this prescription where you essentially project all the interlopers and treat them as effective subhalos, you can write an interloper convergence power spectrum. And this is here on the bottom, this is an expression for the interloper power spectrum, the one subhalo term of the interloper power spectrum. And at a first glance, it might look very different to what I showed you before, but actually it has a lot of similar features. So for one, you have a convergence profile, which again can be a projected MSW profile, for example, but you can see that the relevant length scale has been rescaled by some geometrical factors. We again have an ensemble average. One of the probability distribution, of course, accounts for the mass, but now we also have a dependence on the comoving distance. We have another probability distribution, which accounts for any other profile properties. Remember this parameter vector Q. And now in addition, we also have a dependence on the comoving distance. And of course, the completely new ingredient that we didn't find at all in our subhalo treatment is an integral over the comoving distance between the observer and the source, which includes an interloper selection function, which essentially tells you how you can weight the different interlopers depending on the redshift when you do the projection to treat them as subhalos on the lens plane. And this is an example of what the power spectrum might look like for a very specific choice of parameters. And I'll be discussing this at length in the next slide. But just assume I've chosen some parameters for the subhalo mass function, some parameters for the halo mass function. These are the power spectrum that I get. The red curves correspond to the total power spectrum. So this is adding the interloper contribution and the subhalo contribution. The blue curve corresponds to only the interloper contribution, and the green lines correspond to only the subhalo contribution. And you can see that this, for this specific choice of parameters, the interloper contribution seems to dominate, right? The green curve is almost an order of magnitude lower than the blue curve. But what I want to emphasize is that this was very specifically for a given choice of parameters. And what we can do, or what we're really interested in knowing, is, as I talked about, the relative contribution or importance of one versus the other, right? So I want to know whether what I'm really measuring is the substructure or what I'm really measuring is the interlopers. And so what we can do is look at the ratio of the amplitude of the power spectrum due to substructure or due to interlopers. And the reason why I can look at the amplitude and why it's beneficial to just look at the amplitude is that, for one, remember that the amplitude is determined by essentially the abundance of the perturbers. And sorry, let me close this. Where was I? Okay, it's determined by the abundance of the perturbers. So what we can do is, by comparing the ratio of the amplitude, which remember is just a plateau, we can look at which of the two contributions dominates. And we have the added benefit that this amplitude is insensitive to the specific ways in which I model the halos. So remember that as I go to higher k's, the way in which I actually model the halos, so their concentrations, for example, the inner density profile, like all that is going to change the power at higher k. But the amplitude is going to be insensitive to all this modeling. So that's why essentially we looked at the ratio between these two power spectra. And you'll see that there's three panels. Everything is the same in all three panels, except for one variable that's changed, which is F sub, which is the fraction of dark matter halo mass and substructure. And this is just a fancy way of essentially referring to the subhalo mass function normalization. Okay, so as I'm increasing F sub from left to right, what I'm doing is adding more and more subhalos while keeping everything else fixed. And each of these panels shows the log base 10 ratio between the substructure power spectrum to the interloper power spectrum as a function of lens redshift and source redshift. And notice that redder colors correspond to interlopers dominating, and bluer colors correspond to substructure dominating. And quite intuitively, you can see that as I go from left to right, so I start increasing the amount of substructure in the problem while fixing the number of interlopers, the colors are changing from reddish to bluish, telling me that the substructure contribution is dominating. And so the question that we were interested in is, you know, which of these three values of F sub is more realistic, or, you know, in what universe do we live? Which of the values of F sub are we actually measuring? And of course, the whole point of this distinction between interlopers and subhalos is that we don't have a definitive answer for this, right? If I knew exactly F sub, then I wouldn't have any issue with using the subhalo mass function. It's a very unknown parameter. But one thing that we do know is, you know, from several different lensing systems, there are upper bounds on what this F sub can be. And in particular, for the mass, for the masses that we're considering in substructure, from all the constraints in the literature, although they can vary quite a bit, they all essentially agree that it's much more likely that we're in a regime like this one in the left than we are in one of these two with an F sub of, you know, 2%, 4% or higher. So keeping in mind that it's very likely that we live in, you know, that the lenses that we're probing have an f-sub like this, what we wanted to know is of the lenses that have been already used to you know, in these drug detection pipelines, so something like what Simona Vigetti does, we were interested in knowing whether for these lenses, the subjecture contribution dominated or the interloper contribution dominated. So the lenses are shown as these little scatter plots, scatter points. You can see that the orangish ones correspond to the Slax lenses and the greenish ones correspond to the Bell's lenses. And what we find is that for both sets of lenses, for an F sub of 0.4% or something along those lines, they are both in a regime where we are dominated by interlopers, which is of course good news because it tells us that measurements that have been made for these systems were actually probing the halo mass function and not the subhalo mass function, most likely, which is of course a much cleaner probe of the underlying dark matter theory than if we were in a universe, say like this one, where the, you know, what the dominant contribution were due to the substructure instead of the interlopers. And one last thing that I want to bring up that might be worrying some in the audience is what is the error introduced due to projection? So remember that I said that I'm taking the full three-dimensional array of interlopers and coming up with a prescription to project them onto the lens plane and treat everything as a two-dimensional plane. But in fact, the subsequent coupling of different planes due to the recursive multi-lens plane equation actually gives rise to a curl component that cannot be well accounted for by just using the traditional effective convergence that we've been using here, right? So when we have a full 3D array of lens planes, if we want to numerically calculate the convergence field, which we can do without any approximations, the three-dimensional analog is essentially taking the divergence of this vector field, the deflection vector field. And of course, by essentially, in our analytical prescription, when we essentially erase all those correlations, we are ignoring the curl component of this field. So what we can look at is solving numerically for the full convergence field without doing any sort of approximation and seeing how big this curl component is, because by construction, we are ignoring it in our analytical prescription. And this is what's shown over here in the bottom. So on the left is what we've been calling the effective convergence, which is essentially the divergence component of this vector field. And on the right is the curl components of the exact same field. And what you can see is that the curl component is very, very, very small compared to the effective convergence or the divergence components of the convergence, particularly on the relevant scales. So this is essentially a consistency check to show that by doing our rescaling, our projection, and accurately taking into account the how the masses and any other profile properties rescale when doing that projection, we are not erasing a lot of information by neglecting this additional coupling between different lens planes, which can give rise to this curl component. So let me quickly summarize what I've been talking about, which is essentially, you know, progress that we've tried to make in mapping the dark matter on kiloparsec scales. I've tried to emphasize that gravitational lensing is a very good gravitational way we have of probing the low mass end of the halo mass function. And in particular, you know, the only real way we have of doing so outside of the local group. And we can use it to probe a regime in CDM that so far remains largely untested. And I've discussed several different ways to map the dark matter distribution on these scales. I spent some time discussing ways that we can enhance direct detection techniques with machine learning. So I showed methods that have comparable sensitivity to traditional ones, such as gravitational imaging, but they're much more model independent in the sense that you don't have to go through that additional step of modeling individually the main lens and the source before doing any inference on the substructure properties. And of course, it's orders of magnitude faster, which is its main advantage. And then I spent some time discussing a statistical probe, the convergence power spectrum, which can be sensitive to lower masses and direct detection, which is great if what you want is to falsify dark matter theories. It provides a direct link to dark matter theories because, again, these theories make statistical predictions on the distribution of dark matter, not on, you know, the properties or placement of individual clumps of dark matter. And then we spent quite a lot of time worrying about this interloper contribution and what that could mean in terms of, you know, inferring dark matter properties from strong lensing systems. And we found that it's very likely that interlopers dominate, at least for well-known galaxy-galaxy lenses, which, of course, is good news for the ability of this field to actually constrain the particle nature of dark matter. And I just want to emphasize one last thing, which is that I've been quite optimistic about statistical detection techniques compared to perhaps direct detection techniques, because our focus has been with dark matter science. But I want to point out that for other science goals, so for example, time delay crystallography to measure H-naught, a direct detection type of technique can be preferable if you want to, for example, get a very high fidelity lens model where you incorporate, you know, these specific clumps wherever they may be in your image before inferring something else, like for example, H-naught from your strong lens image. And with that, I will open up for any questions that people might have.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Anna. Here, let's applaud either virtually or all, like, people, you can also, they can turn on the volume to applaud. So here, I will applaud audibly. Okay, so we are a bit over time, but we can take a few questions if there are any from the audience. So people can just unmute themselves, or if you want, you can raise your hand. But I could maybe start off, with a quick question. So you mentioned how, so you mentioned how it would be better, if the subhalos were subdominant compared to the isolated halos, right? For a number of lenses though, right? So we can see luminous, neighboring galaxies on the image, right? Mm-hmm. And for all the ones, to my knowledge, for which we can get a redshift for that small neighbor, the redshift is always at the same redshift as the main lens. So how do I square that, with your statement, that the line of sight uncorrelated things are much bigger than the correlated subhalos?
Yeah, I mean, so this work is actually, there's quite a lot of work that predates what we've been doing. So there were, I guess, maybe starting in 2015 or so, there were a couple of papers that started talking about this line of sight contribution, where if you look, for example, just at the plane, halo mass function, like a Preschecker or something like that, then different works found slightly different numbers, but essentially they all converged on the fact that there are more interloper halos than subhalos. That's interesting. I'm not too familiar with the systems that you're mentioning. They have the same redshift, so I'm not sure how it really specifically to that.
Yeah, that's right. So for like a number of these strong lensing systems, right, so you can see like a small, tiny little luminous galaxy mm-hmm. near the lensed images. And so for a number of them, you can actually measure like a redshift for that small neighbor. Mm-hmm. So I can think of like a few offhand, but for all those cases, every single one, the redshift coincides with the redshift of the main lens, mm-hmm. right? And so empirically we have this like direct measurement. And so I'm just wondering how to square that,
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I wonder... Right. Yeah. So you mean essentially like, how could it be coincidence that for these systems where we do actually have a luminous counterpart, we can like pinpoint the redshift exactly, like what's the likelihood of all of them being at the lens redshift if the interloper contribution dominates, right? Is that the point?
That's right.
Yeah. That's a good question, actually. I'm not sure.
So for both of those to be true, I guess it's saying that like the luminous satellites don't behave the same way as the dark satellites, right?
Right, exactly. Or all the field halos are dark opposed to those ones that have satellite. The satellites that do have light. Yeah, I'm not sure, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Any last questions? We are like 10 minutes over, I see.
Sorry.
No, sorry. Yeah, it's our fault for asking all these questions. Okay, well, if not, let's thank Anna again. For a great talk.